The headlines: Iran's leader highlights the significance of building good neighborly relations at a meeting with a visiting Turkmen president. Russia advises Turkey against an incursion into northern Syria as guarantor states get together in Kazakhstan to discuss a Syrian settlement. Also ahead, the defiant UK says it will keep working to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda after an EU court ruling grounds the first such flight. Hello and welcome. Our top story for this half hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says his country's policy is to expand relations with neighbors, calling it right policy. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a meeting with visiting Turkmenistan's president, Serdar Berdimuhamedov. He stressed that the expansion of ties is in the interest of both countries and urged joint commissions to seriously follow up on the implementation of agreements. Earlier, officials from both sides signed over a dozen cooperation documents in different fields. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his Turkmen counterpart oversaw the signing ceremony. Raisi said Iran and Turkmenistan enjoy vast capacity to boost their ties and pointed to Iran's determination to sign long-term strategic agreements. Raisi said the Tehran-Ashgabat cooperation would definitely lead to further regional development. Berdimuhamedov, for his part, said his country wants close cooperation with Tehran on issues such as the Caspian Sea legal regime. He also called for enhancing relations with Iran and international bodies. We've reached out to Central Asia Caucasus analyst Omid Rahimi for his comments. He believes there are ample capacities that can help Iran and Turkmenistan increase the volume of bilateral trade.
Growth, 84% growth in the volume of trade exchanges in 2021. This is the outcome of trade exchanges by the two countries in different areas. Prior to this, the trade volume had hit a figure of $2 billion, so there are ample capacities for the growth of such exchanges. I can refer to the issue of gas. Iran, in order to meet its gas demands in northeastern part of the country, it has to import gas from Turkmenistan. The first gas export pipeline outside Central Asia was related to Iran in the 1990s. And it was at the time when Mr. Rafsanjani was the president, and there was another pipeline in 1388 Iranian calendar. It was laid in Khan Kiran, and it was used for transfer of gas to Iran. Turkmenistan, as a landlocked state, has certain limitations for the export of its gas. The recent agreements between Iran and Turkmenistan and the Republic of Azerbaijan have paved the way for other types of cooperation in this said area. That is known as the gas swap. During the visit by our oil minister to Baku, there was an agreement for doubling the volume of that gas swap. That is also an important area, and Iran can turn into a hub for the export of Turkmenistan's gas to other states.
Elsewhere, Russia calls Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise, warning that such a move could escalate and destabilize the situation. Further, Russia's envoy to Syria made the remarks as the Kazakh capital is holding a new round of talks in the Astana format aimed at ending the Syria conflict. Alexander Lavrentiev also described relentless Israeli strikes on Syrian territories as unacceptable, saying the issue needs to be focused on the guarantor states of the Astana process for a settlement in Syria. Namely, Iran, Russia, and Turkey are in attendance at Nur Sultan. There are also the representatives of the Syrian government and opposition, as well as the UN. Ankara says it plans to launch a military operation to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Damascus has strongly condemned the plan, saying it's part of Ankara's efforts to push for a demographic change in the area. Historian and journalist Brett Yonkers joined us with his take on Turkey's planned incursion into northern Syria and Russia's reactions. Let's take a listen.
Syria has been occupied now 4 years by three separate imperialist powers, one of them, of course, being the Zionist entity since the occupation of the Golan Heights. But at the same time, you see, especially in northern Syria, a huge part of Syria is divided either between American occupation forces, which under the so-called Rojava government, the Syrian Democratic Forces and the YPJ, Kurdish majority units. And on the other side, you have the leftovers of the so-called Free Syrian Army and the Syrian National Council that are being protected and defended and led in many ways by Turkey. And both of these, even though they oppose one another, the Kurdish majority American-backed forces and the Turkish-backed groups, even though they gradually and habitually fight against one another, their goals are very similar. Their goals are the takeover of a huge chunk of Syria, the stealing of strategic resources, primarily oil and wheat, and also the ethnic cleansing of a region to supplant the local population, including, for example, in the case of Rojava, including the cleansing of the Arabs, of the Yazidis, the cleansing of the Assyrian population, and the supplanting with people that are considered loyal to this new entity.
Ukrainians ignore a Russian ultimatum to surrender Severodonetsk as the battle for the city in eastern Donbass rages on. The mayor of Severodonetsk says Russian forces are trying to storm the city from several directions, but Ukrainian forces keep on the defensive. The Russian military had called on Ukrainian troops in Severodonetsk to lay down arms and stop their, quote, senseless resistance by early Wednesday. Russia is currently controlling up to 80% of the city. Its fall would pave the way for Moscow to fully control the mainly Russian-speaking Donbass region. Johnny Miller is in Donetsk. He joined us earlier with the latest on the situation in Severodonetsk, the city where the fiercest clashes are taking place between Russian and Ukrainian forces.
It looks like the battle for Severodonetsk is coming to an end, but it might be in the news for at least the next few days or another week or so. Why? Because there are still civilians there and fighters from the Ukrainian army in this steel plant. It seems like a replay of what happened in Mariupol. It may well be a ploy by the Ukrainians to try and hold up the Russian advance. The Russian army said they're going to spend all day today opening up these civilian corridors. The civilians are only going to come to the Russian side. The Russians may well be worried there might be soldiers trying to hide amongst the civilians, so they're taking them to the Russian side. But it may well be that the Ukrainians are trying to hold up the Russian advance, and it may well be successful if they do that. But it looks like Russia has taken Severodonetsk, which means they've taken pretty much all of the Luhansk region. But this battle for Donbass is still going to go on for many more weeks. Just outside Donetsk here, there's still a huge part of the Ukrainian army. They shelled Donetsk, a massive incoming barrage day before yesterday. So, and that, particularly the fortification of Adievka is a major fortification not far from Donetsk. The Russians are still going to have to take major fortifications in Donbass before they can take the whole of the region.
Italy's energy giant Eni says Russia's Gazprom has informed the company of reducing gas supplies to Italy by around 15%. Eni said the plan was put in place on Wednesday. The Italian energy company said it has not been notified of the reasons yet. This after Gazprom announced it would cut the daily gas deliveries via the Nord Stream pipeline to Germany by 40%. Gazprom linked the decision to repair of compressor units by German company Siemens. But the German economy minister says the plan is a geopolitical decision and the reason cited by Gazprom is technically unjustifiable. Italy and Germany, together with several EU member states, rely on Russian gas. The bloc has failed so far to have a unanimous voice in how to cut down on its reliance on Russian gas after its relations soared with Moscow over the war in Ukraine. The British government vows to go ahead with its controversial policy to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda despite criticism and a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. Home Secretary Priti Patel expresses disappointment over the ruling shortly before a plane carrying migrants was due to take off. She insists the order will not deter the plan as a legal team is reviewing the decision and the preparation is underway for the next flight. The plan has already been criticized by rights groups and international bodies, with the UN refugee chief calling it catastrophic. Iran has also called the move a historic disgrace for London. The British government claims it will help stem the flow of migrants via dangerous sea routes. The High Court in London has yet to take a final decision on its legality, but the European Court's ruling is an embarrassing blow to the UK. Journalist Samuel Geddes joined us earlier to tell us more about the British government and what it's trying to achieve through its migrant deportation policy.
What the British government is attempting to do is essentially more or less the same thing that successive governments in Australia have been doing for more than 20 years now, which is to create a sense of xenophobically fueled moral panic about asylum seekers, refugees, people trafficking, in order to essentially turn displays of cruelty against asylum seekers into an election-winning strategy. And speaking has proven to be an incredibly effective electoral tactic. Even those that may not be convinced by the pure cruelty of what's being proposed, other people can be won over by the argument that the British government, as well as the Australian government, has continuously made, that in order to deter people from turning to people smugglers, in turning them in essentially concentration camps on another continent, is actually the moral thing to do.
5 years ago, a devastating fire ripped through a London tower block, killing 72 mostly ethnic minority men, women and children. Despite an ongoing inquiry and numerous government pledges regarding building safety, residents and survivors of Grenfell say another catastrophe is possible unless immediate action is taken. Amina Taylor reports from London.
Survivors, residents of the community, and wider supporters gathered to remember the victims of the Grenfell Inferno 5 years on. Many had gathered in the shadow of the building that still stands as a constant reminder of June 14th, when an inferno engulfed the tower block, leaving scores dead and thousands of others impacted and the nation traumatized. Dignitaries, including politicians and royalty, paid their respects, and for all the acts of heroism during the blaze and in its aftermath, the scars still run deep.
From my perspective, I feel like it's like a Muslim tragedy in London because of the high number of Muslims that were living here, because it was during Ramadan, because of the impact that it's had on the local community. The very first person who was named was a Somalian Muslim out of the list of people who had died in Grenfell. And I think the continuation of our story right now has to be on recognising the impact it had on the community here and what more can we do now.
The reoccurring theme when you speak with people here is the sense of frustration and anger at the way in which survivors, victims, the community, members of their family were all treated and continue to be treated. The pledges that were made, the promises that were broken, and the spectre of another Grenfell being possible.
The official Grenfell inquiry, chaired by Sir Martin Moore-Bick, that so far lasted 4 years and cost £149 million and counting, is attempting to figure out what truly happened and who was responsible. Those still fighting for answers are clear about what justice will mean in this case.
Justice will look like the fact that those people, the leaseholders, people in social housing, you know, in high-rise blocks, are living in habitable, affordable, safe homes. That is what justice will look like on one hand, and on the other hand, as I've said before, justice should look like those who are accountable for, who are responsible for this atrocity, are held accountable.
What I would like to ask this government is, what is it going to take for them to start taking this issue seriously? Is it because the people who died in Grenfell Tower on that night were mostly working class people, were mostly people of colour? Because we know that had Grenfell been in Canary Wharf, that building would not have been covered in illegal flammable cladding. It's utterly outstanding that we're 5 years on, we still have no answers. This community has received no justice, and still there are residents in this country that are living in buildings covered in the same illegal flammable cladding that was wrapped around Grenfell Tower.
Ahead of any official findings, the community of Grenfell march. They remember, and they will continue the fight for answers and justice. Amina Taylor, London.
The European Commission has launched legal proceedings against Britain after London introduced plans to override some post-Brexit trade rules.
This is illegal. The UK bill is extremely damaging to mutual trust and respect between the EU and the UK. It has created deep uncertainty and casts a shadow over our overall cooperation. All at the time when respect for international agreements has never been more important. That is why the Commission has today decided to take legal action against the United Kingdom for not complying with significant parts of the Protocol on Ireland, Northern Ireland.
The official said the UK's move to unilaterally change some of the Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trade agreement has no legal or political justification. The EU has begun three legal proceedings in response to what it claims to be Britain's failure to implement the protocol governing Northern Irish trading. Britain, on the other hand, says it plans to revise parts of the agreement do not violate international law. On Monday, the UK introduced legislation which would remove customs checks on some goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of Britain. London says the changes are necessary to improve trade and reduce bureaucratic red tape. A humanitarian organization is drawing global attention to the worsening mental status of Palestinian children living under an Israeli blockade in Gaza. A fresh report by the UK-based group Save the Children says 4 out of 5 children in the Gaza Strip are suffering from mental issues. It warns that symptoms of depression, grief, and fear have risen dramatically in the past 4 years. According to the report, nearly half of Gaza's population of 2 million is made up of children who've never known life without the blockade. The group is calling the current state in Gaza more critical than ever and urging the international community to take immediate steps. Israel's land, air, and sea blockade of Gaza has been in place since 2007. It has also launched 4 main wars against the coastal territory, killing and injuring thousands. The most recent one took place last year. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on 6 key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. The other point that stands out in the Imam's testament is the need for attention towards Cold War and psychological warfare waged by the enemy. Whenever the enemy fails to achieve its goals in practice, it resorts to psychological warfare to dishearten nations and fill their hearts with despair. Through psychological warfare and intimidation, they try to convince other nations to end their opposition. This can only mean that they have not been able to resist our nation, in particular arenas. The enemy's psychological warfare started in the early days after the revolution, and it has continued to this day. Sometimes they said the revolution will not last longer than 2 months. And sometimes they said it will last for only 2 years. It has been 30 years now that our revolution has continued with full strength and has made the Iranian nation increasingly unified, helpful, and dynamic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, they are waging psychological warfare in various ways. They want to convince the Iranian nation and the Iranian youth that they cannot achieve anything without a connection to domineering powers. This is a grave danger that the Imam has drawn our attention towards. The enemy denies the great advances of our nation. The revolution has managed to overcome several obstacles over the past 30 years. When one delves into the history of world revolutions, they realize that there have rarely been as many obstacles in the way of a nation and a revolution as opposed to Iran's revolution. Also, that all other revolutions are normally thwarted by these obstacles and eventually surrender to the enemy, unlike the Iranian nation. Our revolution has been able to proceed and reach great summits in spite of numerous threats, sanctions, antagonistic measures, plots, and obstructionism. The revolution is looking forward to reaching higher summits and it's proceeding vigorously. Enemies yearn to take this motivation away from the Iranian nation.
You've done, you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
China and the U.S. are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at a security summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese defense minister hit back at the U.S., saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to secede Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand. And his speech was also, of course, very sharp in terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both these people laid out their positions on this, but the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-U.S. relationship. Wei stated that the China-U.S. relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-U.S. relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war. The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative.
The Chinese have had a very ambitious and very successful program with the Belt and Road Initiative, which has helped to fill the deficit in infrastructure in the Asia Pacific, and this is only beginning now. What the U.S. has to offer is a system of rules in which these countries must abide by, possibly in order to attain increased trade, but they're really not offering anything concrete other than being associated with the United States and a few other countries.
Washington has made no secret about its stance on China. But the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure, both militarily and economically. Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed American citizens to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. According to the Labor Department, the annual inflation rate rose to 8.6% in May, shattering any hope Americans might have had for relief from the skyrocketing inflation. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, rising costs of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. In response to the issue, the U.S. Central Bank has since March been raising interest rates, but the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which has driven up the price of oil and commodities like wheat as it disrupts exports from the two countries, has made tackling the problem more difficult. Polls show a majority of Americans see inflation as the top problem facing the country. Consumer sentiment has plunged and U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings have sunk as Republicans criticize him over the issue. But the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry.
This definitely hurts the U.S. economy and Americans. The Biden administration's decision not to push for negotiations between Ukraine and Russia is, to many of us, inexplicable. It's irrational. It's certainly causing enormous carnage and tragedy in that region. And in addition, it's hurting the United States. You know, the average American, when we go to the gas pump these days, I live in California, I'm paying well over $6 per gallon. This is extremely difficult for many American families. So the Biden administration, I think, has been very unwise and damaging in the policies that have been pushed by Secretary of State Blinken and by Victoria Nuland, both of whom are basically neoconservatives.
The price of gasoline in the U.S. has also witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon for the first time. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, namely a record release of barrels from U.S. strategic reserves, waivers on rules for producing summer gasoline, and leaning on major OPEC countries to boost output, have so far proven to be ineffective.
Certainly, the Biden administration should have foreseen these extremely damaging and disturbing consequences. I think that perhaps their policies are driven by somehow, perhaps they think that seeming warlike will help them at the elections coming up very soon. The midterm elections in November are of great concern to the administration because Biden's approval rate is extremely low right now. So they're clearly taking actions that they hope will bolster the results of the election in favor of Democrats.
Saudi Arabia and several other OPEC countries have rebuffed requests by the U.S. to boost oil production beyond the gradual amount. This has led to U.S. lawmakers seeking alternatives to the oil cartel to solve their problems. So far, the U.S. Senate has passed a bill called No Oil Producing and Exporting Cartels Act of 2021. The bill, aside from creating complications for oil companies, is intended to protect consumers and businesses from spikes in costs of petroleum. But analysts warn that implementing it could have some dangerous unintended consequences. Many say the move could harm U.S. energy companies more as OPEC members produce oil much more cheaply than U.S. companies.
The Secretary General of the Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the resistance would not remain silent in the face of the Israeli regime's efforts to plunder the country's maritime gas resources. Syed Hassan Nasrallah made the remark on Thursday after a vessel operated by a Greek company arrived at the Karish gas field in Lebanon's territorial waters to extract gas for the occupying regime. Nasrallah noted the enemy does not recognize the international law and resolutions, reminding that it was not the international regulations, but actually pressure, war of attrition, and resistance that forced the occupying enemy to retreat from the southern Lebanon and the Palestinian enclave of the Gaza Strip.
Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They have MPs inside, and you know, they can somehow manage to maybe adopt a resolution inside the parliament and then move forward with maybe attacking the Israeli vessels and, their workers or so on, to push them away from their resources and their land.
Hezbollah chief also said that the U.S. and Israel are seeking to afflict Lebanon with hunger and partition. Nasrallah said the Lebanese companies that have pioneered to extract the maritime area's resources have been threatened by the U.S. and Israel, warning that Washington and Tel Aviv were after shaving off a large part of the resource-rich area. Lebanon and Israel took part in indirect talks to discuss maritime demarcation in 2020, but they stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, where Israel has given exploration rights to a Greek firm. The talks were supposed to discuss the Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area, according to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers more further south, including part of Kerish. Israel relies heavily on gas and has long been developing a number of illegal offshore gas deposits in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a particularly sensitive issue for Lebanon, which is dealing with fuel shortages amid a worsening economic crisis.
And I'm pretty sure Hezbollah is wise enough to do this with coordination with other political parties inside Lebanon. Hezbollah does not want to control the country and does not want to push the country towards war, but they want to secure their sovereignty, they want to secure their resources, and they want to keep the country a safe country. And Hezbollah has been proven, with all these years, all their sacrifices and their actions. They're a very credible organization inside Lebanon and a political party that has a lot of good allies. And I think that this is a great opportunity, hopefully, to be able to get some more financial support for the Lebanese nation.
Hezbollah says it has the material and military capabilities that enable it to prevent Israel's gas extraction from Kerish. The Hezbollah Secretary General has cautioned the Israeli regime against seeking another war on Lebanon, saying the regime's losses would be greater than those of Lebanon in the event of such military confrontation. This is not the first time the regime has sought to encroach on a nation's sovereign territory, but this time, the response it would receive could be unprecedented.
The US and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted with the support of Israel to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Israel expected the IAEA's Board of Governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the U.S. and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal, officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war. With Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty. And it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the U.S. and its allies, France, Britain and Germany, for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The U.S., however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وقيل له صف لنا العاقل فقال عليه السلام هو الذي يضع الشيء مواضعه فقيل فصف لنا الجاهل فقال قد فعلت.
It was said to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, describe the wise to us. And he said, the wise is one who places things in their proper positions. Then he was asked, describe the ignorant to us. And he said, I have already done so.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. When we look at the universal persona of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, we find that among the different characteristics and aspects that the commander of the faithful Imam Ali had, one of the aspects was that he had a pure and beautiful and perfected heart. Now, of course, the heart has various different aspects and it has various different forces, whether it is anger or carnal desires or jealousy or greed or spirituality or love and kindness and mercy and all these different kind of emotions and moral and ethical characteristics. But it's interesting that we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about various different aspects of the heart, whether it's poverty, knowledge, greed or jealousy. But in one place he talks about something that might be related to the physical heart as compared to the metaphorical heart. In this one place, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if hunger bothers the heart, feebleness will overpower it. And if the heart is indulged in overeating, it will be deprived of breathing. Now, it's quite interesting, but if we just take the physical, medical aspect of this, we will find that it is true in this aspect. For if your body becomes hungry, then you become feeble and weak. And on the other hand, if you are overeating pretty much constantly, you will eventually become deprived of breathing. Now, it's interesting. Hopefully, none of you have overeaten, but sometimes it happens, and you do overeat. And if for some reason you do end up overeating, the next time around, try to remember this saying from Imam Ali. And it is true, when you end up overeating, it almost seems like you can't breathe. Breathing becomes hard. But on the other hand, of course, overeating on a constant, regular basis, not taking care of your health, of course, will deprive you of breathing, meaning that it can very well kill you. We know that in one of the traditions, we find that the stomach is the key to all diseases. A full stomach, excuse me, to be precise, is the key to all diseases. But here, it almost seems like there is many spiritual layers as well, which
we really can't get into, but we just bring up one very simple point, and that is that if you indulge yourself in overeating, and we say that overeating perhaps can refer to the materialistic world, to this consumerism, to constantly want to buy something, this overeating, this overindulging, this israf and extravagance, as it is said in Arabic, it will deprive one of breathing, and the soul will begin to die. A very interesting and thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاجعل نفسي مطمئنة بقدرك راضية بقضائك.
Oh Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
The Salah of Imam Ali alayhi salam is breathtakingly amazing. How can it not be when the man performing it was born inside the house of God and was martyred inside the house of God? But not just any mosque, born in the best house of Allah and martyred in one of the greatest places of his worship. Salah is what shaped the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He loved it, excelled in it, felt no pain during it, and ascended high in its performance. The Quran speaks about his salah in chapter 5, verse 55. He gave his ring in charity whilst in ruku' and God said he has authority from Allah and his messenger. In Saffin and in intense heat of the battle, Imam Ali alayhi salam kept looking towards the sky. Ibn Abbas tells him, "Oh Ali, what are you looking for?" Imam replied, "To see if it's time to pray." Ibn Abbas said to him, "We are too busy fighting." Imam defiantly answers with the reply of a human being in love with his creator, "Why are we fighting them? This is to establish salah." In the same battle, an incident occurred which some have questioned. A scholar once narrated that Imam Ali Salam was injured with part of an arrow that has struck his body. They were told he can only remove it during his salah, since he is so connected to God. He would not feel any pain. After he finished his lecture, a man stood up and said to the scholar, "This story is nonsense. How can a human being not feel any pain when an arrow is removed from their body?" The scholar replied, "The Quran tells us that the women of Egypt were given a knife by Zulaykha. When Yusuf alayhi salam entered the hall, they began to cut their hands unknowingly due to the sheer beauty of this prophet. They did not feel what they were doing. This was the beauty of a human being. How about the beauty of God the Almighty? Ali is so mesmerized in salah that he sees much more profound beauty and grandeur. How can he feel any pain?" This is why it is mentioned that when it was the time of salah, Amir al-Mu'mineen became pale. And when asked why, he would say, "This is the time for the amana, trust, that God the Almighty presented to the heavens and the earth, but they refused to carry it, and human beings accepted it. So how will I deal with it?" Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam lived his life for Tawheed. He was born and killed in the places of Tawheed. His mission, words, actions and guidance was all about monotheism. He saw salah as the foundation of Tawheed. If we love Ali, if we look up to Ali, if we want to live our lives like Ali, then we have to be examining our salah and not neglecting it. Let's look at our salah. How do I perform it? Do I do it correctly? Am I able to focus on the words? Is there concentration? Is my wudu correct? How can I improve it? Seek the wasila of Mawla al-Muttaqeen. Embark on the journey of salah improvement and be amongst those who attain the pleasure of God the Almighty.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The British royal family, an institution instantaneously recognizable throughout the world, positioning itself as both the face and heart of Britain. The monarchy purports to perform a dual role: promote British interests on the global stage, and at the same time sustain and justify its own institutional relevance. The royal family sets out to perform these apparently complementary roles by projecting a carefully crafted and jealously guarded image of propriety, diligence, and unflinching pursuit of duty. To that end, the British monarchy goes to extraordinary lengths to discourage, distract, and disrupt any real scrutiny of its true role and performance. But keeping up appearances is not always an easy task. the recent controversy surrounding the estranged